Hi. My name is Ron. I am an alcoholic. Where's the cute guy who was escorting me in? What was his name? Assholes hiding. He come up to me and says, real tough like macho, and says something. And I said something about how cute he was from the waist, well, whatever. And he says, I said, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to shock you. He said, I've been around a long time. No one can shock me anymore. Never, never say that to me. You will pay. Oh, yes, I came out of the closet this year. Let's get that right out. It was a struggle, but somehow I managed. I noticed there were a few other gay people. I can smell them by their pheromones in the room. And somebody was saying something about, I heard out here saying, oh, you better quit drinking, you know. You've already had two arrests and they could send you to prison. I just never say that to gay guys. It's like enabling them, you know. Oh, what do I do next? Just trying to help out here a little bit. It was good to hear Rhett, the speaker, and I am Ron. Rhett is, what is it, 2.5, and I'm coming up on 37 years of sobriety, and it's important only for this reason that many of you, particularly new people, come in here, and you remember the old says, what's going to happen to us in Alcoholics Anonymous? You know, what will I be like? Will it be the hole in the donut or some other particularly ridiculous comment? And what you need to do is look for role models. If you look at Rhett, you'll see what you could become at 2.5 years. You look at me, and this is what you'll become at 37. One, two, only three left tonight to get a drink. So I was coming over here. I'm a shy little thing, as you can tell. And I was coming over. Oh, they've invited me back here. I just think that's a bee shit. Isn't there a new thing about profanity? Well, I heard there was, but then I heard my friend Judy speak last time, and she said shit and ass. So I thought I can work from there, you know, kind of build on that a little bit, but it's kind of hard for me not to cuss, I must admit. So I've been practicing. I've been down in Mexico. I live down there sometimes, and some of the fishermen have been helping me out. And they've been telling me some words that don't matter, like chingadera and chupa or whatever the important things are. So I'll try to use those tonight. Even have some Arab friends, and they've told me a few I might get away with, and I'll try not to cuss too much tonight. As I was coming here tonight, I'm always a little nervous, really am. And I was, still in the heart of my drinking, the soul of my drinking, I was on one of the many geographicals. For those of you who need vocabulary lesson, that means you've become so obnoxious, so disgusting, so loathsome that nobody invites you to parties anymore. You're getting fired everywhere you go, and you can't even stand yourself. It's like sitting on the shitter, you know, and you can't stand yourself. That's awful. And so you get up and you go somewhere else, you know. You go to Bum Diddle, Nebraska, or, you know, some horrible place. And there you're going to start all over. And you're going to join the local church, and you're going to go to local theater and start running every day and only have two drinks a night. Those are called geographics. And they never work, and we've all done them to some extent. But I went on a geographic up to the Grand Canyon, of all places. Never be a drunk and go to the Grand Canyon. But I used to love to scare myself. And I was working right on the edge of the canyon, a little place called Desert View. And I'd get blind-ass drunk. and I crawl out to the edge and peer over to see how close I could get without falling. It's a real cheap high. There were some people around, you know, kind of urged me, try a little more, Ron, try a little more. But I was thinking, you know, sometimes we scare ourselves. You know what scares me more than anything in the world, if there is anything that truly scares me anymore? I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I would be scared if somebody told me this program didn't exist anymore. If someone told me I had to walk out of here with whatever I bring in here tonight, some good, some bad, some just really farked up. And if I thought I had to walk out of here and try to function, not because the world is screwed up, but because how I perceive the world is screwed up, I don't think I would want to continue to live. I don't say that for hyperbole and drama. I mean it. I can't imagine trying to function without always in the back of my mind, no matter what, Ron, if you don't drink, it's going to be okay. No matter how down you might get, Ron, if you don't drink, there always will be an answer. I haven't seen some of you guys throughout. Some of you know that I took a trip. I'm a retired teacher. I taught your high school students morals for 20 years. By example, dear. Are you going to wave that thing at me? Well, all right. It might be more effective. Just get up and slap the shit out of me. We don't get paid for this, you know. But I went on a trip. I bought a brand new car. Said it's time. My rotten relatives will get my money, you know, if I don't spend it. And I bought a brand new lovely Hyundai Sonata with all the bells. And off I went to the East Coast. Went to visit my sober brother in Florida and bought a house together there. And then I went on to Washington, D.C. and New Jersey. And there I was parked in New Jersey. Went to an AA meeting at the Salvation Army one night. And shortly thereafter, in my motel room, some asshole came along and stole my brand new car with everything in it. And I was a little upset. You know what? Listen, some of you new cars, I'm going to tell you a few things right now that are important. Forget all the rest of the shit. You hear people come in here and say, oh, had a terrible day. I got up this morning and my husband said he wants a divorce. Both of my children told me they were gay. My bank account is overdrawn. I just found out I have tumor of the ovarian cyst and I'm male. And I have all these... This is terrible. And I drove up to this goddamn meeting and my tires were flat. And then they get this moony, placid look. But thank God for the lessons he's given me. Those people aren't sober, dear. They've had a lobotomy. There's something wrong with that kind of sobriety. Oh, I'm so grateful for that. I was not grateful that they stole my car. I was pissed off. I did the right thing that any alcoholic would do with 37 years of sobriety. I curled up in the fetal position and fantasized about homicide. Somewhere in the big book, read it. That's what I did. But you know what is so important for me today? Is there I was. Oh, and you know what? They say that you're supposed to pray. Someone does you wrong, pray for them every day. And it will go away. And I prayed for that son of a bitch for 2 weeks. And I watched the reports on the big storm, hoping I'd see him floating around in the bay. But my prayers were not answered. And he may still be around somewhere. But what was really cool, what's so wonderful about this program, why I love Alcoholics Anonymous, was in that horrible mood, which would have been a perfect time to walk across the street and get a bottle of Red Mountain Pink Chablis for $2.49 and turn it into a wine cooler and get drunk and cry and call all kinds of people and tell them the terrible things. And something just said to me, no, I can't do that. What are you going to do about it? And the program of Alcoholics Anonymous has ingrained that kind of brazened it into my head. These little simple questions. What are you going to do next, Ron? What's the next indicated thing? Well, you call insurance and call the police. And already I knew I was getting better because I was hoping it'd be a cute cop and not some wrestler. And then, you know, you go ahead and I get some clothes and I call and I get an airline ticket back and so forth and so on. And I took care of it. And all at once, by the way, I was in a cab. They talk, what do they call them, little Eskimos here or in Hillcrest, little fairies. I was in this cab. And I was kind of crying. I mean, I was just really confused. There was my trip in my car, and I was sniveling. He said, something's wrong. You're in pain, aren't you? Really neat cab driver with some kind of a Caribbean accent. And I said, yeah. And I told him what happened. He turned to me at a stoplight and looked at me. And he said, you're strong. He said, you got some spiritual values. He said, I'm a pastor. He said, I've been through a lot myself. I was a heroin addict. And he says, but I sense, fine, told him anything about me. He says, you got some spiritual values. You'll get through this. That's the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. So maybe I would say, before I say anything else silly tonight, I would say, there are many things that you hear in Alcoholics Anonymous that I really think are a crock of shit. You know, when people stand up and seriously, with a serious look on their face, they will read that part that says, we realize we know only a little. There isn't a goddamn alcoholic anyway can honestly say that. We all think we know a great deal. It's the truth. And we're more than willing, if you ask us to sponsor you, to tell you everything that we know. You know, or for people to say, you know it's going to get better. It doesn't always. I had a job when I got sober. And I made an amends because I'd stolen some of the money from the damn liquor store to support my boyfriend. He didn't love me. He loved my liquor bottles. And I had to go back and make the amends, and they fired my ass. They call that getting better. I kind of thought maybe I would be, when people would hear what a great amends I had made in the night, except they'd think I'd be maybe ready for presidency of Alcoholics Anonymous or something like that, but it didn't happen. It was just like, yeah, you dumbass, you should talk to your sponsor about that. There are a few things, well, quite a few things that I don't much care for, and that's just my own opinion. Although there's this much. 37 years of sobriety entitles me to be an expert in Alcoholics Anonymous. That really pisses people off. Look, put it this way. Are you sober and you're sober 20 days? So you get somebody who's 15 days sober to be your damn sponsor. That's like asking someone to follow you down the road they've never been. That's asking you to take you to a whorehouse and they've never sampled the wares. Why do you want someone who hasn't been where you've got to go? That's the value of long-term sobriety. That's one of the things I don't like when people say, oh, well, I got up this morning, but anybody who got up 2 hours before me is more sober than I do. What is that shit? No, it isn't. Part of what we share here is our experience, strength, and hope. And if you're new in the program, you got a hell of a lot of experience, but you don't have a lot of strength and hope that I need right now. So sobriety matters, long-term sobriety. We know a lot about what doesn't work. We know a lot about what it means to screw up and fall flat on our ass and not drink. That's what's valuable. And so I say tonight that if I don't know anything else, and if I ever forget to say this, it's like I'm an alcoholic. I haven't had a drink today. Some people like to say they're a real alcoholic. It's kind of like a Real Housewives or something. It's just, what a crock of shit. What the hell is a real alcoholic as opposed to? But I'm an alcoholic. And if I haven't had a drink today, I am exactly here at this podium with my screwed up foot and all the things that I still have and the fears and the loneliness and things we bring to this program. If I haven't had a drink, I'm exactly where I am supposed to be. And I believe that. I heard some poor devil at a meeting recently whining on and moaning, and people were getting up and patting him because he was sobbing and choking up. And he said, I'm just not doing it right. I just got to work harder at it. I know that the things and the promises aren't coming true. Dumbass, are you sober? Telling me how the program is not working for them. Are you drunk? Are you an alcoholic? Oh, well, no, but, you know, my wife has left me and I still hate everybody. Good! You're where you're supposed to be. That's not taunting you. My program says that pain is the touchstone to all spiritual growth. All of it. Thank you, brother. Hallelujah. Remember me when we come into the... You know what? This program is about pain. I heard a lady say in a meeting one time, she's one of these new age weirdo bitches, and she read too much Al-Anon or something, or Hazleton literature. She had this starry-eyed, moony look, and she says, I have managed, three years sober, to learn to grow without pain. My answer to that is, why the fuck bother? Pain is not only a touchstone to spiritual growth, it can be really invigorating sometimes. We all know what it means to need a little spanking sometimes. And Alcoholics Anonymous will provide that. We understand that. It's wonderful. It's wonderful to see them blush. I know I'm doing my job. I want to talk a little bit. I don't see the clock. Where's the clock? How long? All right. But you'll get tough on me, won't you? All right. Y'all heard it. Recently, I was having a conversation. I usually go back into my turgid, terrible childhood, and I'm very dramatic and so forth. And it was kind of dramatic. I was recently talking to my Marine brother in Florida. He's become such a case. He's a retired First Sergeant Marine, as tough as they come. And he's my best friend. And up until 6 years ago, he was drinking himself into a liver necrosis. The doctors literally said to him, you cannot do this more than a few more months. Your liver won't stand it. And he had other things, the hepatitis C, he won't mind me saying, all kinds of things that go with that. But most of all, he was dead inside. He had no place to go in here. He'd done it all. And he didn't, like I didn't, want to come to Alcoholics Anonymous because we were both children of a really psychotic Baptist minister. Hallelujah. And we had some real issues with this whole thing about God. And I was managing to work myself through this after 37 years. But he wasn't. He was angry. He says, I'm not going there. He says, I've heard what you talk about. You talk about God. I don't want, this makes me so angry. I just can't even unclench my fists. I don't want to hear it. And so I said to him once, I just says, okay, do whatever you want, bro. I said, I love you much and I hope you're around a while, but I can't ruin your life. So I said to him in a burst of wisdom, I said, Crush, if you think there's a problem, why don't you just try not drinking for 90 days? You say it isn't such a big problem with you. Try for 90 days and go to these dumbass meetings that you hate. Sit there and grind your teeth, you know, slash their tires. Do whatever you have to do, but go to the meetings and don't drink. And after 90 days, if you still think it's a crock of shit, that bar is still there and I'll buy your first drink. I would. Well, he's my heir, so why not? And he did. And he's sober coming up on 6 years today. And we talk. Program. You know, you're supposed to have, a woman can't have a man's, that crappy shit. That happened to me in 1976 when I arrived. I got this old mean dyke to be my sponsor. I wanted someone tough. And I knew she was tough because I called her up one time and told her all about my lover being mean to me. And she said, I'm not a goddamn marriage counselor. And slammed the phone down. along with a couple other gay people, said that to me. So I knew she was right. And she come in the meetings with her chains dangling, you know, her leather. And I said, that's for me. And people said, oh, you can't have a woman sponsor. You need to have a male sponsor. Well, why? Well, so that you won't get confused. So, I said, all right, I'm down. So I found the biggest, meanest biker that they had at Pathfinder's. That's the man I want. I looked him up and down, and I says, I want what you have. I'm willing to go to any lengths to get it. And he was my sponsor. So sometimes the rules don't all work. But my brother had said, I don't give a shit about this sponsorship. He's a reader of the book. And I know my friend, dear friend Keith, will correct me on this. My brother says there's nothing in the book about sponsorship. Big book. Is that true? In the stories there. But not in the important part. Not those rattly-ass novella stories. There's nothing in there about, I love novellas. I was pregnant, and now I found out it's my grandfather's child, but I was married to my cousin, and now I'm blah, blah. Sounds like an AA meeting. No, sounds like adult children of alcoholics. I've gone there sometimes. Anyway, he says, you're my sponsor. Absolutely violates all the rules, but he's still sober. So the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is working for him. And we had a long conversation recently. There were 10 children in my family and his. We sometimes admit to being in the same family. And we both grew up in a fundamentalist Christian background in Michigan. And my father, as some of you know, was another one of those real alcoholics. Kids had to go home, drag him from the Harvard Tavern back home every holiday because he was down there drinking. Beat up on my mother and beat up on my kids. And some of us look back and think it might have been better when he was drunk because he couldn't catch us. But after he got sober, he could catch us. And then he got religion. And things really went to hell then, pardon the pun. And we've had big, big time issues with my father. My brother says that I got beaten more than any of the 10 kids because he said you were too stupid to cry. I think that's kind of an alcoholic behavior too. I would just stand there defiant. I will not. I will defy you. I will make your life miserable. And my father would look at me and he said, there is a devil in you, Ronald, and I will beat it out. And I was just ecstatic with that kind of praise. We've been talking recently about our experience and how we handle it in Alcoholics Anonymous. And for some reason, that's on my mind tonight. And I've been hearing people talk about their childhood and how it affects their lives. And it certainly does, doesn't it? It's a part of every damn four-step, or should be. If it isn't, we're not being honest. And I wrote my four-step, and I did the best I could to be honest in there. And I talked about, you know, it doesn't say that we go back and blame our dad and our mother. It says we find our own character defects in that inventory. We look at where we were wrong, but damn, it was so hard, you know. Yes, I stole dad's money for the church off the dresser, but he gave me a hell of a beat. No, you can't put that in. But I just want to. So we talked about that. And my response to that, there's a lot of that talk going on in meetings now. You know, not just in ACA and Al-Anon, but AA. So I think it's fair to broach the issue as a recovering alcoholic with some joy and some confidence that I really hated the man for many, many years. I blamed him for my ongoing, almost rabid fear of men, particularly heterosexual men, because, like my dad, they occasionally pummeled me more than I really even wanted. They weren't always sure. And because also it was more than the physical violence, my dad never, ever said to us ever once when we were growing up that we can remember, Crush and I, that he loved us. Never hugged us. And that all sounds really sad. And in a way, it kind of is. But here's the point. I have a sister now in Al-Anon, and she gave me high praise the other day. She's going through a divorce. Her husband cheated on her, and she was surprised. Why are we women ever surprised about those rotten, dirty, good-for-nothing cheating dogs? There will come a time when we won't need them anymore. Batteries, and that'll all be fine. Think about it, gentlemen. Think about it. It's coming. But we were talking, and I was talking with her, and always when I talk about it, she talked about her drunken husband, she talked about her daughter who is in prison, she talked about her son that she lost when he was 13 in a terrible car accident because her husband was drunk and the kid died in her arms, and all of that is enough to rip your guts out. And it has ripped my guts out because I love her dearly. But I reached a point where I realized the sympathy. The poor, oh how awful, is not useful anymore. It's not useful. I'm not helping her. So I started talking about Al-Anon. And I started taking her once in a while to a meeting. And every once in a while, you know, we'd get in. And recently she said to me, the best thing you ever did for me as a brother, Ron, was a couple years ago I was telling you about something sad about my daughter going to prison again for drugs. And you said to me, well, I'm really sorry, Noam, but what the hell are you going to do about it? And that is a question that we need to be asking as sponsors and asking each other in meetings in a general way, I think, more. What are we going to do about it? Here's what I did. My mother died in 2000, a few years before that. My father, at 85 years of age, had an affair with a church secretary. Some of the boys in my family are real proud of that. But the old 85-year-old guy, he went out and he found a church secretary and he said that she was God's gift to him. And then he said something, because he was a theologian, he said he'd researched the letters of St. Paul, brother. You know about those letters from St. Paul to the Corinthians. And he found out that he was never married to my mother. Because she wasn't a Christian. That was 63 years and 10 kids later. He decided he wasn't married. He was going to run off with Sally. So we decided he couldn't because if he did that, we were going to take away Social Security and a lot of other things, and he was going to mow lawns, and so he had another spiritual experience and decided to stay with Mother. But he was in a lot of pain about his Sally. So he came down to my home. This is a little queer son that he had beaten over the head with clubs and Leviticus for many, many, many years. And he came down to see me because for some reason my father said to me, I kind of, unlike the other kids, he says, I think I can talk to you without you judging me. It's amazing. Don't be too sure, Dad. But I said, yeah, you can do that. And we sat down in the living room and we talked. I talked to him about breaking up with my boyfriends and how awful it was and how I had to tape numbers to my telephone so I wouldn't call them. And he said, in the songs, I hear Sally, the music we love together, probably Amazing Grace. I said, yeah, Dad. I says, but what you got to do is not contact her anymore if you're done. And then I looked at my dad in that living room, and without any anger, without any bitterness, with a calm voice, I said, you know, Dad, you are a terrible father. You beat your kids. Oh, I was just doing spare the rod. I said, no, it wasn't about sparing the rod. You beat the shit out of us because you were angry. That's why you did it. And you never properly cared for your kids and loved us. And he started and said, no, Dad, this isn't for you. This is for me. This is for me. And I said, and you know what, Dad? Through all of that, I have made a conscious decision to forgive you. And I do. I forgive you completely here today. And I'll always remember where I did it. And that doesn't mean even that you necessarily deserve that. I'm forgiving you because I don't want to hate and be angry anymore. And I'm talking about this a little bit because there's so much of this still going on in Alcoholics Anonymous. My book says that I've got to forgive, that I must forgive. It isn't always easy, but we have the steps here. And I did it because my program says that I have a right to live a life full of joy and abundance. To live a life of joy. The joy of living is the theme of AA's 12th step, and I wanted some of that joy, and all that hatred kept me from it. When my father died in 2008, after my mother died, and he found some other little filly and hooked up with her for a while, and then he died. Some of you know I'm not always really spiritual. And my father, we got along, you know, we could laugh. I would say, come on, Dad, Adam and Eve were brother and sister. What do you think about that? And off he'd go and we'd have a great theological discussion. But my father had a stroke and he was coming in and out of consciousness up in El Cajon. And I went in and I leaned down to Dad. Nurses, he knows your voice. I thought he should. And I leaned down and I said, Dad, this is your daughter. Ron? Yes, Dad. And later on, and so I told him, it's okay, Pop, you got to go, but it's okay, you know, and we do love you. And later on, I was a little naughty. They told me I had to give him his medications. And the hospice nurse left, and I leaned down to my father, and I whispered, I'd waited a long time for this. I whispered, and I said, Dad, I'm going to be giving your medications tonight. I'll be giving your suppositories every hour. And he went 8 hours later. My brother said it was self-defense that he passed on. So I got that off my chest now. I want to talk also a little bit about what it means to be a drunk. And there are a lot of variety of drunks here tonight. There was my first year of sobriety. This woman came into Pathfinders. Pathfinders, rough shit. I wasn't an inmate there. I wanted to be, but they thought I had a conflict of interest. But I went to meetings there all the time. And this woman came in, and she got up at the podium, and she said, oh, I just can't take it anymore. This is my first 30 days. She said, I've got to stop drinking. She said, I know I reached my bottom. I have a beautiful home in La Jolla, and my dog peed on my Berber carpet. There's the bottom, lady. You know, and some other guy got up and said he was tried to kill his third wife, and that was his bottom. And that's kind of the variety that we have here. I suggest for me that my bottom was an inside job. And I could have continued to pour that shit in my system for a while yet. And I could have gone to jail again many times. I could have gone to lose another job. But when I was done, there was something dead inside. That's what I know about a bottom. And I know that because I came in 1974. And I should have been done drinking. I should have been done. I had already been to jail and the psychiatrist and gone and got baptized several more times. So I was almost waterlogged. I'd done it all. And I came in 1974 and been fired from another job. And you would say, well, surely he's going to stay. And I waited 30 days after drinking alcoholically and blackouts for like 10 years. And I, thank you, dear. Don't be shy. And you would say, well, this guy, you know how people say that? Oh, well, look at him. He's done or she's done or no, they're not ready. We don't fucking know. Fucking know. I should have been here. I'd already done those things. And I came in here. And I, all the things that you said, you know, the jails and the family and the drinking and the terrible. Remember the god-awful hangovers? Those hangovers where I'd go answer the door and nobody rang the door. I'd answer the phone. It wasn't even working, you know. Hello. Where things crawled on your skin. Partly that wasn't all the booze. It was those funny little white crosses that I was into. You know, Vato, those little white crosses that used to get over the bar in Tijuana. Oh, God, they rocketed me into many dimensions. And so I was in big, deep shit. And I came here, and I stayed 30 days. And I heard all the things that I can say to you tonight, and you've heard many times. If you're done drinking, you want to stop drinking, we love you. Don't love yourself. You don't have to suffer that way anymore. You don't have to feel that way anymore. This is a place where we'd be accepted no matter who you are. And I heard all that stuff, and I did what they told me, and I went to meetings, and after 30 days, I went back out and drank again. And I had a very good reason. Some of you had shitty reasons, like you wanted to drink. I had an elegant reason. I went camping with my boyfriend, who came back, by the way, when I was sober, because I had a paycheck again. And I went camping with him, and I told him, he was drinking a bottle of wine, I told him to go gather some firewood for the fire. And he didn't do it. That is a damn good reason. And I got drunker than shit, and it was his fault. And I decided I didn't need Alcoholics Anonymous anymore. Too many hypocrites. Too many weird people. Hookers and bikers and ex-convicts and even some Baptists were allowed in the meetings. And I thought, now, look, I told you I was going to write a letter of resignation to Alcoholics Anonymous and tell them where I thought they didn't have it quite right and make some suggestions. I went back out and I drank and I pursued this disease into the gates of insanity and death. And I've never in 37 years not mentioned this time because it's kind of a leitmotif for me. But I was at a bar or at a party up in San Francisco where I'd gone another geographical because I figured if I could be up in San Francisco, no matter how drunk I got or how drunk my boyfriend was, it was a very welcoming place and we could put our relationship together and stop trying to kill each other. He tried to kill me one time shortly while I was up there. And I locked myself in the bathroom and he was stabbing through a door, true story. And I cowered in the bathroom, the wood was splintering, and then he says, "God damn you." He said, "I'm too drunk, but I'll get you in the morning." And then he went and passed out, and of course, like all drunks, next morning didn't remember anything about it. And I went to a party that night, and my boyfriend, some of you know what it's like. I was very possessive and jealous, because I had other issues besides being a drunk. And he was down in some room doing something. And it was not Bible study, brother. He was doing something in that room. To this day, I'm not quite sure. But I went back out and I got myself a tumbler full of gin. Boom. And that didn't work. So I got a handful of Preludin. It's kind of an old smoothie-out drug. And all I got was numb. That was my pitiful, by the way, and incomprehensible demoralization. Because for all alcoholics like us, from the time I first had that shot of scotch when I joined the Navy at the age of 18, went out and defend your country. Marching around. Hot two, one, two, three, four, seven. From that time, I had that little shot of scotch and something miraculous happened. We alcoholics know. Everything changed. It's a miracle. It's truly, Lord, a miracle. Those people who hated me didn't hate me anymore. Being shy and stupid and self-loathing all at once, I was the most wonderful person on earth. A shot of Chivas Regal did it. And that's what we pursue into the gates of insanity and death. That wonderful, wonderful paradise escape from all the shit around us and just a drink. We'll do it. And so this particular night, nothing happened. I flew home, gave up everything. I wanted to be where my dad was because he was a preacher. And I think deep, deep in the soul of every alcoholic is the need for a power greater than ourselves. Call it whatever you want. And I went and I just followed my father around. I weighed 129 pounds. I was very near death. And they knew it. You'd say, well, he's done now, isn't he? Look at him. Took me a little while. They nursed me back to health, gave me some food. And I got on a plane and headed back to California, where this time I was going to get it right. This time I was going to drink just a couple drinks, watch some Shakespeare and NPR, and then I'm going to go to bed and get up in the morning and go jogging and join probably the Cancer Walk or something noble. And in 1976, on June 23rd, I went out on Juniper Avenue for just one drink. You know that? Remember? Just one drink. We meant it. And then there were a couple more, and I was feeling a little better. And, well, I'm not going to go home right away, just a few minutes. And then it was midnight, and I didn't know where I was. And it was 2 o'clock in the morning, I didn't know where my car was. I didn't know where my wallet was. And I was walking down the street. And like a lot of us in that condition, we're terrified of being alone. People say they like to drink a lot. I was terrified. And there were two men walking down the street, and one of them was armed. Don't remember a lot, but I remember that. We don't give a shit. It's insanity. I invited them home to just to be with me. And when I woke up the next morning, and I was all beaten up, and my eye down on my... And there was a lovely lady, my aunt. She had talked to me about sobriety long before that. This time she walked in. She always said, oh, it's not your fault, Ron. It's because you're gay in the straight world. It's because you had a rotten childhood. Rat-a-tat-a-tat. She walked in, looked down at me. She said, you want to continue to kill yourself? I'm not going to watch. There's a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I went to that meeting, and I was done drinking. I didn't care. I didn't care what you asked me to do. I didn't care what you told me about God. Somebody even said at one point that I would have to be heterosexual. I actually said some old redneck from alcohol and says this, your queerness will be removed in the sixth step. Did? That is real terror. And some of you straight guys laugh about that. I went home and I got in the shower and got on my knees frequently and I said to God, if I have to be straight, just give me the strength. I don't. 2 weeks later, I looked at Playboy magazine and there was a centerfold. Nothing happened. I thank God for freeing. But some of you straight guys, what if you were asked? You have to be queer to stay sober. Ha! I was ready to go to any lengths. I would do anything. And I even went to these meetings and listened to all this bullshit in meetings. And they say that they like you in Alcoholics Anonymous. They did not like me. I went to those afternoon meetings at Pathfinders, and they stared at me. Sit down! One time, I know. And one time, I'm going to go another 10. And not one time, this guy got up and said, if you're going to get in Alcoholics Anonymous, you can't sit on those damn fire escape. You got to go get in a chair. Did he know who he was talking to, this queen? I got up and moved to the chair. You know why? Because I had no place else to go. That's what kept me here. And the pain kept me here. And the pain drove me to the steps. People say, oh, you can't just not drink. The hell you can't. You go ahead, you newcomers. Just don't drink because you're going to feel so friggin' tortured. With all the shit you bring in here, you'll turn to these steps or you'll drink or you'll jump off a bridge. Hallelujah. You will. Thank God for bridges. Now, in my final 2 minutes, I haven't had the 1 minute yet. No. What I want to say also is that sometimes we forget in all this glorious drunkalogue and sadalogue is that one of the things I always wanted to do since I was a little girl was be a teacher. And I used to practice it. And one of my drunks, I woke up in a nut house. And they had strapped me down to a gurney. And because I was a danger to myself and others. And I thought, that's it. I will never get to teach. My life is ruined. And 3 years ago, I finished 20 years of teaching at the college and high school level. And I departed the school with a clear record and with a great deal of respect. I owe that absolutely, substantially, totally to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was a good teacher. I was a gifted teacher. And I want to say in my final 30 seconds something because it matters to me. I addressed the senior class, and many of them knew I was a recovering alcoholic. And then the next to the last year before I left, they asked me to speak to the senior class on their commencement exercise. And I love Shakespeare, some of you know. And I used to teach Macbeth. I loved that part where she said, I would tear that sucking baby from my nipple and smash its face against the wall in order to kill the king. And I said, that bitch is tough. It's kind of what I told the kids. But there was a line. There was a line in Shakespeare where Macbeth is standing out on the fortress, remember? And all the enemies are coming that he had screwed over. And all the people he loved are coming after him. And all the people he hated. And nothing is left. And he's gonna get it. And someone comes in and says to him, the queen, my lord, is dead. And he didn't whine and scream and be dramatic. He said this, "These are important to me," he said. "Tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow creeps in this petty pace from day to day to the last syllable of recorded time. In all our yesteryears have lighted fools the way to dusty death. Out, out, brief canto. Life is but a poor play. Struts and frets its hour away upon the stage and then is heard no more. It's a tale. It's a tale told by an idiot full of sound and fury and signifying nothing. And I told my students that I felt exactly that way when I got sober. But I said, because I found recovery, and I told them all, I said, I don't care how far down you have gone in your lives, you can pick up the phone, you can call someone, you can get recovery, there's always hope. Because I said, today it's not so much Macbeth. Today it's Forrest Gump. And life is a fucking box of chocolates. And that's what sobriety is for me. I love this program. And I hold it out to you to get done. To get done with what you gotta get done with and come here and pick up these simple tools. And to do that, first of all, my brothers and sisters, if you're alcoholic, you don't drink. Don't drink. It's really good to see you all again. Thank you.